glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. It must be time to talk about wildlife because Scott Craven is back with us. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist and stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
Hi, Jill. I'm doing great. Hope everybody else is, too. The weather's been wonderful for a change.
It has. It has. So what wildlife questions do you have for Scott? Join the conversation. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So speaking of weather, how is our weather's been up and down? We've got weird stuff going out west. How does that affect the wildlife in our area?
Well, wildlife populations are, of course, tuned to habitat, and habitat is dictated at least in part by weather conditions. No rain there's been some rain in southern and southeastern Wisconsin, but we're still officially classified as drought status. And as I wander around, a lot of the wetlands I try and keep an eye on and small ponds and all are simply gone. And that's certainly not good news for animals or species like amphibians that require that water, especially for breeding during the summer. So those kinds of things will be having a tough time. But in the bigger picture, some of the things that are going on are just downright scary. Seeing the Great Salt Lake dry up to its lowest point. A big pelican colony there has disappeared, and dramatic impacts on other birds. The news out of California that some of the big rivers like the Russian and Sacramento, I think it is, are getting so warm that entire year classes of salmon are dying. That's a big deal for the West Coast. And of course, we're suffering from the smoke from the vast fires across the West and into Canada, and that's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres of habitat that are being incinerated. Now, in the long run, that habitat comes back, but it takes a long time, and there's an immediate loss of life for a number of species that can't get out of the way. But the whole thing's a pretty scary situation, and unfortunately, reaching some consensus about proper action by us humans is pretty elusive. So I'm hoping things get better, but we'll see.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely a scary situation. We're talking about summer, but really fall is just right around the corner. That means that many hunting seasons are going to start. Why don't you give us a little preview on that?
Well, there are a lot of things coming up, and even though the seasons are not open, and the earliest one, I think, in Wisconsin will be September 1st, but that's only literally a few weeks away, there are many things that hunters are doing already, and in some cases have been doing for some time, in terms of getting their dogs ready and back into hunting shape and taking off some rough edges on the training, putting up deer stands, out wandering around potential places of hunt, seeking permission from landowners, scouting. And of course, there's a new game in town, and that's trying to find ammunition. As you've probably seen in the news, ammunition has been in very short supply for some bizarre reasons, but it's starting to come back on the shelves, and hopefully by the time hunting season rolls around, it will be readily available. And I see that the DNR put out a release recently that the farmland zone antlerless deer tags are now available, so people who have already purchased their licenses can go online and designate what county and whether public or private land they want, and then they can print those tags, so they'll be ready to go. And it behooves all hunters as well as non-hunters to keep their eye on what's happening as far as changes in regulations that might affect someone's outdoor activity or hunting opportunity. For example, there'll be no sharp-tailed grouse hunting again in 2021, and Minnesota's joined on to that as well. And, of course, there's the controversy, as it just seems to go on, about a wolf hunt this fall and what the ultimate quota for those animals will be after that bizarre hunt back in the dead of winter that caused so much turmoil. So lots of things going on, but the upshot is that on September 1st, the dove season and early goose and teal seasons will open, and a couple weeks later, the archery deer hunt will get underway, and then things will be in full swing over the few weeks over after that. So Lots of opportunity. It's a great time in Wisconsin. Great weather, great opportunity for our many outdoors people. And hey, go for it. Have a safe season and get ready.
There you go. It's hard to believe that that's so fastly approaching. Oh, my goodness. Let's go to the phone, Scott. We've got a couple of calls already. We've got Maureen in La Crosse with a question. Hi, Maureen.
Hello. Wondering if what we saw is typical. In May, we had a doe and her young deer that we had seen just coming out near our house and moving around. And one day I heard a bleat, which I realize now was a fawn. Saw the mother kind of thrashing at the ground and then kind of hung around, but we were able to see the fawn had died. And for about 10 days, this mother kept coming back, and she'd kind of circle the area or stand sometimes for 20 minutes, just kind of stand and look at it. So I'm wondering if you have an idea of, is this typical behavior for a mother, for a doe, when the fawn has died?
Well, Maureen, I think that the one lesson there is, and then there's a caveat, one lesson is that mothers are mothers, and mothers of wild animals are very protective, as are human mothers. So whether it's a sow bear protecting her cubs, or whether it's a doe whitetail protecting a fawn, they have, or a mother robin with young on the ground when they shouldn't be, no matter what it is, they're protective. They have a tremendous investment, so to speak, biologically and energetically in those young, and they do everything they can to see them through to maturity. However, lots of things and lots of problems befall fawns. I don't know what killed the one that you found, but it doesn't surprise me that the parent doe would have visited the site at least for a little while to, you know, see if there was any mysterious recovery or whatever else. The caveat that I mentioned is to try and, as people, we try and apply anthropomorphic thinking to a wild animal, and that's a very difficult thing to do and isn't really appropriate. So what the animal's motivation might be, or whether it's, you know, consciously thinking about this or you know, hurt by the event, who knows? No one knows. But the fact is, biologically, these female animals have a great investment, most of them, in their young, and they pay careful attention to what's going on. We had my own recent story about fawns was our next-door neighbor. We live out in the countryside, and next-door neighbor came over with some video footage from their security camera. And it was dark, but it clearly showed our shared driveway. And the first image was of a coyote came into view on the screen. It was dark, but there was enough illumination to see that clearly it was a coyote, and it had a fawn in its jaws. And there was a lot of bleeding and commotion, and right behind the coyote came the doe into the frame, and then everything was gone in an instant. But in that case, the doe was clearly trying to do what it could to get the coyote to drop its fawn and again save it. So things like that happen all the time. In human terms, they may seem cruel and unfortunate and so forth, but there's enough reproduction usually to swamp the losses to predators and that kind of thing, so that in the long run the deer population and everything else sustains itself. Okay. The long answer to your question, Maureen, but I hope it gave you some solace in what happened.
Yeah, hard to watch, but it is nature. Unfortunately, that stuff happens all the time. Speaking of coyotes, we had Mike in Iowa County who couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to know about the coyote hunt. How many animals were taken? Do you have that information, Scott?
No, I do not, and I'm not sure it's tracked very well. It's a very long coyote season. And it's just one of those things that's kind of out there. It's not promoted to the extent that deer hunting or waterfowl hunting or grouse hunting is. It's an opportunity. Some people pursue it. Some coyotes are trapped. Some coyotes are hunted and shot. But while I think that the surveys the DNR does at the end of the year would indicate a general number, I don't know what it is, and it's not carefully tracked, nor are the animals carefully managed like some of these other game species are.
Okay. And before we go back to the phones, I just want to let everyone know we do have open lines. The number is 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send us an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. So let's go to Judy in Horicon. Hi, Judy. What's your question?
Yes. My question is about birds. Every spring when I sit out on my porch, I hear all these different kinds of bird songs and chirpings. And this year when I sat out, I didn't hear hardly any. And I used to see up on the telephone wire a bunch of birds. Well, they look black from down here, but a bunch of birds spaced, you know, properly spaced. And I haven't seen that this year. All I see around here is just basically crows and a few sparrows and once in a while a dove. But I used to see finches, cardinals, you know, other kinds of birds. I heard about this disease that was hitting songbirds coming from the east, but they said it wasn't in Wisconsin yet. So I just wondered about birds. Where did the birds go?
Well, that's a very common question. And it's often associated, especially at a time when we perceive that, gee, there should be lots of birds around. Where the heck are they? Sometimes related to, gee, there's no birds at my bird feeder. Sometimes it's I'm not seeing them or hearing them during the summer. What's going on? And it's a common tendency to equate that or think that that's in some way due to some sort of a calamity, major environmental problem, new disease like the one that people are concerned about right now being spread by some species that you mentioned was in the east, but as far as I know has not been documented here yet. But there's just a natural tendency to say, hey, something's wrong. But in the vast majority of cases, it's usually attributed to something natural and relatively normal, usually some type of weather conditions. Now, depending on where you are, it has been incredibly dry here in southern Wisconsin, and some species have just not been common. It pays to pay a little attention to when certain species come and go. For example, the birds you mentioned spaced on a telephone wire are often starlings, or red-winged blackbirds, or some other species like that. Now, male red-winged blackbird is one of the most common visitors to my feeding station. I haven't seen one now for a week or so, but this is the time of year when redwings, which is an incredibly common bird, start to gather up in large flocks in wetland areas and agricultural areas in preparation for clearing out and heading south fairly early as birds go. So, you know, one I could look at that and say, oh my gosh, something's happened to the red wings. But no, it's a natural seasonal fluctuation in their population and abundance. And many of our species, most of our species, in fact, in Wisconsin, are migratory and come and go. So it's usually a weather phenomenon, too dry, too wet, plenty of natural food, so they're not coming to feeders, not enough food around, so they move to another area. Somebody in the neighborhood's got a better feeder than I do, so oh, they're there for a while. Anyway, bottom line is, although there's a general decline, people are concerned, ornithologists are concerned about a general decline in birds overall, globally, that's probably not something that's detectable to the individual around their backyard. So my advice is be patient. Be out there next spring, sitting on your deck listening, and the odds are pretty good the birds you're hoping to see will be back.
Thank you very much for that question. Appreciate that, Judy. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Christina Myshock is our technical director today, and Jane Rotunda is our producer.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking about wildlife with Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist Scott Craven. Join in. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, Scott, before we go back to the phone, somebody mentioned to me that you are have quite the backyard pond water garden thing going on in your backyard. What's going on there?
It's a mess out there right now. I used to build the occasional water garden for friends, and I enjoyed kind of digging them and building a little water feature, and realized quickly that it was a terrific way to add a habitat component, namely water, and particularly moving water to the environment where perhaps water was not readily available. And that resulted in all sorts of opportunities for wildlife around the yard. So I had a water feature in the backyard here where I live now. It's been in place for, boy, it must be close to 20 years now. And it had degraded to the point that it wasn't particularly enjoyable anymore. There was a lot of silt in it. I was having variety problems. Anyway, there's a big crew here today. My days of moving 2 or 3 tons of rock are probably behind me. So there's a crew here working on it. But the interesting thing was I was aware of the number of species that can be attracted to water. When the pond was functional, and really up until it started being removed this morning, I'd have deer coming into the yard to get a drink. There was a hen turkey that was a regular visitor to come and squat down and get a drink. Frogs showed up out of nowhere. How the frogs ever found the little pond,
crazy?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I recorded over time 7 species of the 12 we have of Wisconsin frogs and toad were in that pond, including a bullfrog a couple of years that, Where the heck did that thing come from? Anyway, yeah, I realized it was a great thing. So when the demolition started this morning, I said, gee, I had a few goldfish in there for the grandkids to look at and watch and so forth. And by the way, for the listeners, if you have goldfish in a pond or a tank, don't release them in a wild body of water. That's a very dangerous thing to do. So mine are confined to that pool, and I didn't think there were more than a half a dozen in there. Well, we removed 52 this morning. and some of them were the size of a good-sized brook trout and mm-hmm. just about as wild. So yeah. They were actually reproducing in that little pond. And then I said, well, there's a couple of green frogs in there. I don't want them. It's so dry. I got to get them out of there, put them in an aquarium, and I'll put them back in the new pond that's being built. Well, I thought there were 3. I caught 26.
That's
and when
a
the
lot
guys started moving boulders this morning, they asked me, say, you got a lot of snakes around here. And I said, oh, my God, don't tell my wife that. But so the point is the pond, the backyard pond, is a great example of the kind of the old mindset from the famous movie Field of Dreams a few years ago, that if you build it, they will come. And that applies to any number of little habitat projects that somebody can do around their home or on a larger scale around their rural property. And if those species, be they birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, are in the area, they will come and they will utilize what you've done. And it can be pretty rewarding. So the take-home lesson there is pick a project that you want to try, like a water feature, or some type of planting, rock garden, whatever, and keep a little journal or put up some trail cameras. And I think you'll be amazed at what is around the typical backyard or rural property that you don't even know is there. So
for sure. Yeah, they're good at hiding.
Yeah, that's what's happening with the backyard pond and the Craven property.
I have to ask you, Scott, because I've put in a couple of water features myself and was just mystified at all the frogs and whatnot. And I put in some goldfish. And again, they were there for at least 5 years before one really bad cold winter got them. But they started changing from gold to black, I'm assuming, to disguise themselves from predators. Did you have that happen?
Well, I have one among the 50-some that we removed. I had just about every color combination to the point that some of them looked like small koi, which they weren't. But I'm not sure that they necessarily change the pigment, but goldfish come in many colors. And if over time they're reproducing, I have many more kind of bronze colored and black backs and bronze bellies and whatnot than I put in.
Sure.
So that may be a favored color combination under the muddy environment I created. But anyway, I was amazed at how many were hiding out in there.
It is. It is. Although I had a blue heron come in and robbed me of quite a few of them, so they knew they were there. So.
Yeah, the blue herons cleaned out my son's koi a few months ago, much to the dismay of the grandkids. But there are ways to put on the bottom of a pond, put a couple of two or three rocks in, and then lay a big flat flagstone on top of those rocks so that the fish have something to get underneath, or in a pond that's not particularly clear. Sink one of these plastic milk crates that are sometimes used for storage and whatnot, put a rock on that, and then there's something they can get in and out and then get away from raccoons, mink, herons, or anything else who would like to turn your fish into a sandwich.
Great idea. All right, well, lines are full, so let's go back to the phones. We've got Cindy from Camp Douglas who has a comment for us. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, good morning. In this global ecological crisis, we have to allow nature to heal and restore herself. And I see this pandemic, and I see the droughts and the wildfire and where it's getting flooded and rain. You know, it's all a reflection of our complete disregard of nature and the natural sources of life itself. So when I, in the last Wolf Hunt, which the public was totally against. So I called around to, like, voice my opinion, and I kept getting shuffled over to other places. I called the DNR. Oh, you have to call your legislator. Oh, you have to call, you know, keep going on and on. And then I find out it's a lawsuit from outsider groups called Hunters Incorporated, with a professional law group called Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And I know these guys are probably going state by state doing their hunting wolves. For some reason, the wolves are the enemy. But without these keystone species, we cannot, nature cannot restore herself, cannot heal herself. And so whenever I hear the words manage, harvest, it makes me cringe.
Okay, well, thank you, Cindy. Scott, what's your comment on that?
Well, I'll take the last comment first. And unfortunately, caller is correct. Most of the problems we face right now, when you start to dig deep enough, the root cause of most of these problems is human activity of some sort. And it's very difficult to get people together and on board to try and reverse that, especially when it's very painful economically, financially, or what have you. However, I think the comment about management, or the euphemism for killing, which is harvest, to make a blanket statement that is all bad is absolutely not the case. Many of the species that we enjoy here in Wisconsin now, like the recovery of bald eagles, trumpeter swans, it's a long, long list. It's all because of management by humans, by biologists and agency people who were trained to know what to do to reverse the problems these species were having and bring them back. And some of them simply would not be here now in the absence of scientific-based management. It's as simple as that. The harvest issue is really part of management. Species that are on the game species list can be harvested because there's enough, their population dynamics allow it. In other words, taking some gobbler turkeys in the spring makes little difference to the future of that population. Harvesting geese, when geese are as incredibly abundant as they are, and the problems they're causing in urban environments is, again, not only entirely sustainable, just like cutting corn and planting it again, or harvesting trees in a pine plantation, but is necessary to try and meet some human objectives where problems are being caused by some of these very abundant species. So I guess the take-home message for me, and that is, yes, the caller's right. Many of our environmental disasters and problems and pressures are coming from people. I do not like the caller. I don't like the intervention of outside groups, like the group that filed suit in Wisconsin to force that wolf hunt last winter. And she mentioned the Hunters, Inc., the caller did, but the group was called Hunter Nation, or Hunters Nation, based in Kansas, I believe, that filed that suit. And I think here in Wisconsin, we're capable of taking care of our own issues and problems. So anyway, it was an interesting call.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy. Appreciate that. Next, let's go to Jim in Denmark. Hi, Jim. What's your question today?
Hello, guys. I have a question about swallows. We have a farm in Denmark, outside Denmark, Wisconsin. And this spring, two nesting pairs of swallows moved in. And August 1st, 7 all flew off. And so we had 3 young survive, our cats. But the question is, where do the swallows go after they leave northeast Wisconsin? Do they head down to Mexico? Seems like a pretty long way.
Well, since you brought up swallows, Jim, I don't know whether it's because it's been so dry around me and therefore insect populations are down, but it's been, for me, a very thin year for the typical tree swallows, barn swallows, and so forth that are normally around my property. In fact, I've hardly seen any. And there are no nesting attempts on top of the gutters or windows or anything else. They're just not here. So, but these birds are flexible enough to move to areas probably around large wetlands where there are abundant insect populations to take advantage of that kind of thing. So this gets back to our second caller who was concerned about, you know, a general lack of birds around where she normally saw a lot. In my case, no swallows. But typically, tree swallows, barn swallows, and so forth, when they're abundant, everybody sees them. They're around for the nesting season. And then, like the blackbirds, they tend to gather up in flocks fairly early in the season, about now, and again, move to big areas, places like Horican Marsh or other big wetland complexes, and gather up there until they head south. And depending on the species, I mean south in terms of not only Mexico, but Central America, even South America. And so they have a long flight ahead of them. And they're really not in Wisconsin for much more than 25 to 35% of the year. Otherwise, they're elsewhere. I don't know if that got at your question completely, Jim, but they're off on their own. You were lucky to fledge some young and lucky to have some birds around, because I didn't.
Okay, thanks for the call. Mary and Nina emailed that she had coyote scat in her yard, and when she saw one in a commercial area of her town, should she be concerned about that?
Well, I mean, she can be concerned if she wants to be, but there's no reason to be. I'd be very surprised if there was a suburban area or an industrial area anywhere in Wisconsin that didn't have coyotes. They're all over the place. And if she's curious about what they do in these communities, I'd refer to two things. There's one project going on here in Madison called the Urban Canid, C-A-N-I-D, for dogs, the Urban Canid Project, dealing with coyotes and fox. And a lot of those animals have been captured and collared with radio transmitters. It's pretty interesting to see the way they move through a human-dominated landscape, primarily at night. And there's another reference, if she wants to track this down on the internet, a faculty member from Ohio State by the name of Stan Garrett. And he has a similar urban coyote project in Metro Chicago. And the maps that he's produced of the radio locations of these coyotes and how they hang out around golf courses and parks and then roam around city streets and busy urban neighborhoods, primarily, again, under the cover of darkness, is really pretty amazing. So that's a these animals are very common but very secretive. And if she wants to see what's going on around her home where she finds scat, I'd recommend putting up a trail camera, borrowing one, put it up, and you'd be surprised what you might see. Not only coyotes, but all sorts of other strange stuff.
Absolutely. You know, we had a letter, an email rather, from Margaret in Keenan, Wisconsin. It was an interesting wildlife experience that she had, and she had a question. So the picture she described is there was a roadkill deer in the ditch with two bald eagles and several crows on it. Now, all the birds flew away as they approached, except for one eagle that could not fly. So she called the DNR reporting line and was told that the animal rescue people would be notified and perhaps someone would come to pick it up. Now, she's wondering what the likelihood is that someone did come to get the eagle and how can she find out?
Well, I have that here. I have the pictures and was looking at them and read the message a couple of times, and I wasn't sure how to respond because the only not knowing the county or who she talked to or whatever else, the only thing I can suggest is that she work backwards from the contacts and see what actually happened, if anyone knows. My guess is that, you know, eagles are pretty big, they're pretty visible, they're pretty charismatic, they get a lot of publicity. It's difficult for folks in the chain of command to disregard a report of an injured eagle. And it looked like from the pictures I looked at that one had a bad wing. From whatever cause, nicked by a car or whatever. My guess is that if they went back and looked around and the eagle was gone, that someone did come and capture it and take it for rehabilitation. Eagles are frequently rehabilitated, but I don't know. And the only way she'll ever find out is to go back through the steps that she took to notify people and try and follow that trail and see if someone can give her the answer she's looking for.
Okay. Thank you, Margaret. Appreciate you sharing that with us. Let's go back to the phone. We've got Pat in northern Wisconsin, and he's got a question for us. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. About 1971, a group of us bought 640 acres of land, kind of turned it into a hunting area. Didn't kind of turn it into. We did. But we've got wildlife openings in there and probably 5 miles of roads that are clovered and maintained and mowed every year. And we used to have a heck of a population of grouse. I mean, every year we have 150, 200 grouse out there at least. And they were pretty well shot off every year. But every year they, a big comeback, lots of grouse. 3 or 4 years ago, we haven't had a comeback, and there's not very many grouse left, but, the habitat's the same. We have a diverse growth of popple, and we have the roads that are cut off and clovered, and I'm just wondering if there's a disease or what happened.
Well, Pat, you and a whole lot of other people in the northern part of the state are wondering about that, because a couple of years ago, there are a couple of things that have happened. Number one, with COVID last year, the annual spring drumming surveys were not run. So we're now forced to compare what was found this spring with what happened back in the spring of 2019. There's kind of a gap in there. And the results of the drumming surveys, which are used to monitor what's going on with the grouse cycle, have recently been published, and they were in Outdoor News a couple issues ago. And in the North Woods that you're referring to, the drumming counts were down about 7%. And the folks who monitor these things are taking that to mean we're on the first year or two of the downhill slide into relatively low grouse populations that will persist for a few years and then rebound so that I would just, for the sake of argument, say in 7 or 8 years, perhaps as many as 9, will be back to a peak population. And presumably there'll be more grouse around on your property and everybody else's. Now, while that cycle of 10-year periods of abundance has held over many, many years, it really depends on where you are. Even with the last couple of years, and in my experience and with my group going up to my cabin to hunt, grouse have been kind of hard to come by. And on the other hand, I hear folks traveling, you know, I'm up near west of Minocqua, people traveling over toward Hayward reported, oh, yeah, we had lots of flushes, and, you know, the guys did really well as far as hunting. So it depends a little bit. I can tell you that they're declining over a broad landscape, but that's not even, as is the case with all wildlife populations. There's quite a few here. There's not so many over there. So your property, it sounds like you've done some great things for management in terms of the clovered trails and whatnot. But what's happened in some parts of the state is just a general aging of the habitat. There's not as much aspen on the landscape as there was 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. The forests in southwestern Wisconsin, the old farms have grown up, and their grouse are very hard to find in that part of the state, whereas they were once abundant. So anyway, it's a combination of habitat maturity, the influence of the 10-year cycle of grouse abundance, and you mentioned disease. There's still some concern, and there's been sampling for the last 3 years of the impacts of West Nile virus, which was identified in grouse. The results so far on that surveying said, yeah, it's been found in grouse, but it's probably not a major influence. So there are lots of moving parts here, but I agree with you. Where I hunt and where I have some property up there, they've been scarce. And that's likely to get nothing but worse here for the next 3 or 4 years as we drop into the low of the cycle. That's the situation.
Okay, thank you, Pat. We're talking about wildlife with Scott Craven, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We're talking about wildlife with Scott Craven, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. Make sure you join us tomorrow when we check in with our consumer protection people about what scams are currently on the rise and how to protect yourselves against them. That's 11 to 1230 on the Ideas Network. And Scott, we've got lots of calls, so let's go back to the phone. We've got Lynn in Stevens Point. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. Someone called in a little bit ago asking about the bird disease in the eastern part of the country. And I just read an article yesterday from the Cornell University, you know, with the bird center that they have there. And they said that they think that the eye problem that the birds were having, the fungus in their eyes, was caused by eating the cicadas that were everywhere, because cicadas can bring up a fungus from the ground. And they also thought that probably the paralysis and things were caused by people spraying those insects.
Okay, thanks, Lynn. I think David Drake mentioned that last time he was on. Have you heard any more, Scott?
I have not. I haven't seen any new explanations. That's, of course, you know, when there's something major going on like that cicada emergence, and it was centered in the east, then kind of cause and effect gets blurred. But it certainly seems plausible. They're a pretty big insect, though, in the species that were being affected. And I don't know. I think time will tell. But if, in fact, it was a response to cicadas and they're gone, and therefore the spraying will be gone, then the good news is that bird disease is not something we need to get anxious about. If they pin down the cause, then when our year class, whatever it is, emerges down the road, or any cohort of cicadas emerges again, then we'll be ready for it from a bird standpoint.
Lots to look into on that. Thanks, Lynn, for sharing that with us. Next, we've got Patricia in Portage. Hi, Patricia.
Hey, Scott, I wrote the Mad Raven Speak Living Wildlife column for the Cap Times, and I am wondering, I know that the wolf overkill and the coyote constant killing and the predator assaults are primarily because we have, from the 1850s, hunters and trappers controlling our state agencies by funding them on killing our wildlife. And it is really high time that we democratize this agency to represent the 90% of us who do not kill wildlife. We have no say in the deciding boards, in any of this process. We can speak up, but we are not heard because people that want to kill wildlife will continue to grow the deer herd on an agricultural model, kill the bucks for heads on walls, and leave the does to produce more. So we have so many deer, so many turkeys, an imbalance in nature because of who controls it. So when are we going to have you guys stand up for all of us to have balanced ecosystems, balanced funding, and balanced proportionate participation in our own nature? We are losing a million species to extinction. We are in climate change like it threatens our lives. We need to change the system now, and I'm asking for your help.
Okay, Patricia, I know where you're headed with that and where you're coming from, and I guess my response is going to be that I think better times are ahead from the way you talk about our agencies, but and I say that because there are at the national level something being promoted by a couple of national level organizations that states are starting to buy into on a pilot basis called relevancy initiatives, where the agencies are in fact attempting to broaden their reach in terms of constituency groups. I don't think Wisconsin's currently involved in that, but they certainly may be at some point. However, in the meantime, there have been steps taken in terms of the Conservation Congress and their online voting to democratize the process in a little more broad way. And I would also point out that all the agencies, including our own DNR, do a tremendous amount of environmental work beyond overseeing hunting, which is a relatively small portion of what the DNR does. However, it generates a disproportionate share of public concern because it's so visible, especially things like the deer hunt that are a huge cultural event here in the state, whereas monitoring groundwater in the Central Sands may not be on too many people's radar screen, even though it's important. So I think better times are ahead, but it's difficult to make blanket statements about who's steering the ship. So we'll see what happens.
Okay, thank you, Patricia. Let's go now to Mary in Spooner. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Part of the reason that parts of Wisconsin, northern, well, probably the whole state, are not seeing the birds is because of that terrible cold front that hit Texas and Missouri and all of those states down there where they winter, like your bluebirds, all your thrushes, robins included, and especially your insect eaters. They were devastated down there because all of their food froze.
Interesting point, Mary. Thanks for bringing that up. I haven't seen many reports on that, but you're right. There were some anecdotal reports that there was mortality, and there had to be. I mean, it was a disastrous series of storms. So some of the species that are in thin supply, like the swallows we talked about a little while ago, which are insect eaters, may very well have taken a beating there. Now, that's bad news. It at least allows us to maybe put a finger on some of the things people have been talking about today in terms of declines. But the good news is that these populations, wildlife populations in general, are pretty resilient. And I would expect that a weird circumstance like what happened in Texas will not happen again for a while. And these populations will bounce back over a few years. So we can hope that that's the case.
Okay, thanks for sharing that with us, Mary. I heard that you're going to be leading some more tours this winter, Scott. Where are you going to be off to this time?
Well, funny you should mention that. Yes, I'm really looking forward to a couple of tours coming up this winter. And this is sort of the kickoff announcement of these, and I'll mention how people can get involved, because in the past we've attracted a pretty good core of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners and just had a great time on both of these. And I've done both of them before. The first one coming up chronologically is called Yellowstone in Winter. And it deals with cool winter hotspots and wild western wildlife. And these tours, this one and the one to the Everglades about a month later, are put on by Door County Nature Travel and a good friend of mine, Paul Renier, who's an excellent naturalist. And we get together and head out on these tours. The Yellowstone tour runs January 30th to February 5th. And we meet in Bozeman and then head into Yellowstone Park. There's some activities in Bozeman, but we spend 4 days in the park, two at the Snow Lodge at Old Faithful. I mean, right literally on the edge of the Old Faithful geyser. And on the last trip, I was out there one morning watching the eruption, and I was the only human being standing around that huge boardwalk that you usually see filled with hundreds, if not thousands, of people.
Wow.
I was the only one out there. That's pretty cool. So, and it was cool, by the way, as you might expect in Yellowstone at the end of January. But 2 days at Old Faithful and 2 days at the newly remodeled and newly reopened Mammoth Hot Springs Hotel, which I'm really looking forward to. So we're right there immersed in the park. There are very few people in there because the accommodations aren't available. Travel is restricted to just a couple open roads, but mostly by snow coach, which is how we travel, which is surprisingly comfortable. And you get to see a lot of cool stuff. It's one thing to see a hot springs bubbling away in July, but to see it bubbling around surrounded by snow and ice is really neat. So bottom line, this particular tour for that 6 day period, again, it's through Door County Tours and Door County Nature and Travel. And I think if people are interested in trying to get involved in either one of these, and I'll describe the Florida trip in just a moment, the contact information is an email address, DoorCountyPaul, all one word, DoorCountyPaul@gmail.com. And he takes people for these tours based on first contact. So they're limited. I think the Yellowstone tour, because of the capacity of a snow coach, is probably 14 or 15 people or less. And the second one is entitled Florida Wildlife, Birds, and Natural Areas, and that's February 24. There goes my cell phone. Let me get rid of that.
There's an ostrich.
Somebody's trying to get on the tour.
Yeah, there you go.
February 24th to March 1st, and we meet there in Fort Myers, fly into RSW, Southwest Regional Airport. And it's a neat place to, it's a nice little airport. Anyway, we meet in Fort Myers and then head out to the Everglades and spend, I think it's two or three nights at a neat little hotel in Everglades City, and spend a day at Shark Valley in the National Park Service property, a tram tour in the so-called River of Grass, a beautiful place. We spend a day doing some hikes on the Big Cypress Swamp National Site, do a couple of other hikes. On the way back toward Fort Myers, we visit Corkscrew Swamp, the famous Audubon Society sanctuary, spend a little time on the beach. If you're from Florida, if you're from Wisconsin, and you're in Florida in February, you expect to be on a beach for a few minutes, and we will do that as well. But, you know, it's just a great time of year to be down there and enjoy the warmth. So if you don't mind cold, go to Yellowstone. If you want to get warm, go to the Everglades, or do both.
Or do both.
See how it works out. But they're great trips. I really enjoy them. We have a great time. We always have a terrific group of people. And again, if you want to get the whole story with an itinerary, the costs, and all those details, get a hold of Paul at DoorCountyPaul, all one word, @gmail.com. And if something's going haywire there, get in touch with me, and I'll get you in touch with Paul. Okay.
All right. Perfect. Anyway. Thank you. Thank you very much. And then we just have a minute or so before we have to break for the news. But what's going on with this Operation Deer Watch? What's that all about?
Well, that's a pretty neat thing. It's another citizen science opportunity that the agency makes available to our people. And in this case, Operation Deer Watch is designed to give everyone, listeners like you folks out there, a chance to contribute to the data that guides deer management. Now, I know there's been some concern about management and what the DNR does, but believe me, the deer herd needs some form of management. Depending on your point of view, too few in some places, too many in other places, but management is warranted. Anyway, the idea is that people will be able to collect information on sex ratios, reproductive success, how many fawns they're seeing. It's easy to do through checking in on the DNR website and signing up. It's an easy thing to do. You can print a form. It runs through the end of September. It's a good deal.
Perfect. Thank you. You did that quite concisely. I appreciate that. We're talking about wildlife with Scott Craven, and we'll be back with more after this look at the news. So please continue to listen. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking wildlife today with regular guest Scott Craven. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. What wildlife questions are on your mind? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And we do have a couple of open lines. And let's go to Ellie right away from Madison. She's been waiting for a while. Hi, Ellie.
Hi. I have a question about swallows. Somebody else called in, and I was reminded of this question. I was fishing out by the Viroqua, and we were under a bridge, and a swallow must have fledged too early. It was about adult size, but still kind of scruffy. And it actually, like, did a breaststroke for a while and got up on a rock. And my partner and I were kind of wondering, what are the odds of a swallow like that surviving? And is that common for them to swim like that?
I'm sorry, Ellie, I was the connection or something was bad. What species are we talking about? I know what happened, but what was it?
Oh, a swallow. I'm not sure. The ones that make nests under bridges. I don't know the names of specific swallows, but.
So it was a swallow.
Yes.
Yeah,
and it ended up in the water. Well, it's not usual for them to be in the water, but some of them drink on the wing, for example, and maybe a little miscalculation or whatever, they end up in the drink. But most birds are capable of swimming, at least to the point that they can, not with their feet, but generally by paddling a bit with their wings and get to some place where they can get on a rock or on a branch or crawl out on shore and dry out and go about their business. While I was fishing last weekend in northern Wisconsin, I had hooked a little bluegill, and it floated away. It was injured, and all of a sudden I heard a whoosh, and an eagle came down literally right next to my boat and attempted to grab the fish and ended up in the water. And I was like, now what's going to happen? And it paddled around a little bit with its wings, and all of a sudden it managed to lift off. And away it went with the fish.
But it was fully
immersed and ended up on a limb where I assume it shook off, dried off, and was back in business. And I suspect any bird that hits the water like that, if it can find security, they're okay. But if not, if it's a bird flying across Lake Michigan or a large lake and for some reason ends up in the drink, they're probably a goner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks for sharing that with us. And speaking of swallows, Lisa in East Troy emailed that they ran their livestock tanks over the top to give the swallows some mud for nesting. Although they did not have as many as usual, they did have several nests that were successful. Great idea.
That is a great idea. And that, that's another explanation for why those birds went elsewhere. There was simply no soil moisture, at least around my place, where they could have gotten any mud. So for a mud nester, got to go to water. So Interesting. That's a nice point on how these things kind of all work together. And if you think or dig deep enough into some observation, like where the heck are the swallows, and eventually the light comes on. Aha!
Ah.
No mud for building the nest. So
that's important.
Yep.
Let's go to Marlene in Clam Lake. Hi, Marlene. What's your question? Oh,
yes, I'm concerned. My husband and I are concerned about turtles. We've seen very few nesting females this year, and a sad indicator is dead ones on the road, and we've only seen a couple dead ones on the road. So we want some hope about turtles.
I'm not sure what to tell you. I don't know whether I just didn't get out and do as much driving as usual, but it's a pretty unusual year when I don't rescue a couple of snappers or a number of painted turtles from the road. And it was just one painted turtle this year up in the northern part of the state. But again, I think the root cause is probably the bizarre precipitation patterns we've had. And maybe they were going other places to nest. But if you're, I've heard of, other than general concern that, yes, highway mortality is a problem, a variety of other problems that turtles face. But if you're concerned, I'm just looking here, my suggestion is, if you and your husband are concerned, go to the DNR website and check out the Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program, which is very actively involved in, again, it's another citizen science program to document turtle distribution, nesting sites, road mortality hotspots, that kind of thing. And this is a way, Marlene, for you to contribute, but also to get in touch with some like-minded people and the database that's being collected to see if there's really a fundamental problem out there or if this was an abnormal year related to the precipitation patterns. But I think you're right. I didn't see a whole lot of turtles out and about either.
Okay. Thank you, Marlene. Appreciate the call. Next up is Keith in Forest County. Hi, Keith.
Good afternoon, Professor. Thank you very much for your time on WPR. I have an eagle or maybe even a more general basic animal behavior question. And this involves my experience with an eagle in distress some time ago. I'll try to keep this short, but I was sitting on my dock enjoying a day, and I heard a ruffling noise in the woods in a little hill next to my dock leading down to the water. After a moment, an adult, or at least I thought it was an adult eagle, tumbled into the water, landed on its side, slowly righted itself, and using its wings, paddled itself to shore, climbed back up onto the hill, and then did the same thing by falling into the water and pulling itself up. I'm frantically trying to decide what I want to do here, so I run back to my cabin, which is about 200 feet away, grabbed my camera, thinking of myself first, and then went down to see the eagle, which had subsequently climbed up out of the water, off the hill, and into an opening in my property. It saw me, I saw it, and I went back up the path to my cabin to try to figure out who to call. I ultimately called the Raptor Center in Antigo. But while I'm on the phone trying to get the number, this eagle had followed me by at least 200 feet up my path, up through the woods, up a hill, down a hill, up to my house, and crawled up onto my stoop and watched me as I was making my phone calls. It subsequently turned around and flew off and flew away. But my question is, did that eagle see me as a potential source of help? What was the relationship that eagle was trying to establish, if any? What was going on there? Can you be of some assistance here?
Wow.
Well, I wish I could be, but I think I'm going to be absolutely useless. That's a strange one. I was trying to figure out where the story was headed, making some notes here, and the tumbling into the water a couple of times and trying to get back out and so forth, that kind of disorientation and lack of coordination is often indicative of some type of a poisoning event, like lead poisoning or something like that. So that's where I thought it was headed, but you say ultimately it flew off and seemed to be okay. Is that correct?
The poisoning, the nice lady from the Raptor Center suggested some poisoning indeed. But I guess the question basically is, did it see me as a source of potential help, or did it see me as something that might be there just to ensure that it was going to be safe while it was able to get its bearings?
Well, I guess, you know, being a fellow human with you, I'd like to think that the eagle, whatever the source of distress was, that the eagle perceived this is, I mean, we're stretching the limits here, but, you know, some source of help. And all I can suggest as support for that are some of my own experiences when, for example, finding an animal in distress. I remember a case in the backyard here a couple of years ago where I looked out the window and it was a deer hanging from the 6-foot fence around my orchard. It had tried to jump the fence, ultimately to do me harm by eating my apples, but nevertheless, didn't quite clear the fence. Its back legs passed through the upper course of the wire and it was hanging upside down and in considerable distress and probably doomed without some help. Well, I went out wondering what I was going to do about it, and I thought the animal would struggle mightily upon my approach, but as soon as I approached, it went limp and just sort of sat there watching me, allowed me to walk up to it, kind of put its body in a bear hug, and ultimately lift it out of the fence from which it was entangled, and then I gently set it down. It hesitated for a matter of a split second, and whoosh, it was gone. You know, things like that. Lots of people have encounters like that with wildlife. There are lots of them documented where rough grouse become unusually tame. And I had many cases when I was working with people calling, say, yeah, I've got a grouse in the yard. And every time I go out with the lawnmower, or ride my lawnmower around, the bird comes out and flies up and sits on my shoulder and rides along with me and things like that. So, you know, these things are kind of fun to think about and anthropomorphize a little bit, but I don't know if any animal behaviorist could actually give you an honest, factual answer to that, because sometimes these things are just beyond our grasp. But I think it'll do us both good to think that eagle thought you were a source of assistance and maybe wanted to make sure you were dialing the right number or whatever. But ultimately, when it seemed like it had what it needed or felt better or whatever, it took off. So I don't know what else to tell you, Keith. It was an interesting story.
For sure. Could it possibly be, since we do rehab so many eagles, that maybe this eagle did have experience with humans helping them out?
Well, that's another good point, that birds that have been, for example, rehabilitated, like we talked about a while back, and had recovered perhaps with, who knows, days or weeks in a flight pen at one of the facilities, came to associate humans with a source of assistance, if not food.
Sure.
So, you know, I know there are people on northern lakes that get a great kick out of catching a few fish and stunning them, or after they're cleaning fish, putting carcasses out on the dock and essentially having eagles come down and feed. Maybe not the greatest thing to do, but and probably some people would view it as illegal. But nevertheless, people do develop a keen attraction to these animals, and the animals in turn recognize people as a source of food and maybe in some cases help or companionship. I simply don't know.
Definitely.
It's sure fun to see and think about.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we talk about the people at rehab facilities and whatnot, but a lot of them are volunteers. And we wanted to talk a little bit about some volunteer opportunities that folks can get involved with helping wildlife in Wisconsin. What suggestions do you have, Scott?
There are a slew of them and some really neat ones, and a couple of them have already come up. The Project Deer Watch that we did rather hastily just before the news break is one that's just rolled out here 2 or 3 days ago and runs through the end of September. We mentioned the Turtle Conservation Program because of Marlene's concern over turtle numbers, but The Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey has been around for years and years for people interested in helping document the status of frogs and toads. The Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative does all sorts of statewide surveys and monitors rare and endangered species. The Wisconsin Bat Program runs acoustic detection, checks summer roosts, and monitors bat populations. The Carnivore Tracking Program is very important in determining the numbers and distribution of wolves and other mammals in the northern part of the state. A big recent one is Snapshot Wisconsin, part of a volunteer network running hundreds, if not thousands, of trail cameras around the state, generating millions of photos to collect information on wildlife and its distribution. And there are others, the Carner Blue Butterfly Monitoring Program, the Rare Plant Surveys, and on and on. All these are handled and administered by the DNR, and all of these benefit wildlife and all of us in a general sense, which is why I get anxious about broad accusations about the agency doing nothing more than catering to hunters. That is simply not the case. And all these opportunities are available. You can go to, for more information, there's a website, go.madison.com/DNR-citizen-science. But I think if you just go to the DNR website, which is very user-friendly, and type in the search line, citizen science, you come up with all sorts of things you can get involved with and make a nice contribution to conservation in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. Lots of great opportunities there. Thanks for sharing that with us, Scott. Let's go back to the phones real quick. We've got Abby in Altoona with a question. Hi, Abby.
Hi, thank you. So I have, for over 50 years, been swimming on this lake in Polk County, and I was swimming across the lake, and I was swimming back, and I saw two loons, which, I mean, there's a couple pairs of loons on the lake, but so these loons were literally, I think, well, they were chasing each other. One was chasing the other. I'm not sure who was chasing who, but and they stayed on top of the water for a very long time. Like, they were still, by the time I got across to the dock, they were still going at it. And, I mean, typically I think they would have been exhausted. So I thought at first they were young, learning how to fly, but I was like, no, they would have totally been exhausted by that time, because it takes a good half hour to go across the lake. So I was just curious as to what kind of behavior that is. Territorial?
Well, it most likely, when loons can be very aggressive toward each other, and most particularly, they require pretty good area of water to support a pair. And when an intruding loon, particularly another male, drops in for a visit, the resident male can be pretty territorial and pretty aggressive toward it. And sometimes the ensuing battle is very protracted and lasts for a long time, like you saw. Sometimes it's a matter of, hey, a couple of rushes and the intruding loon says, well, not so friendly around here, and they're off to another lake. However, with behavior like this, whether it's loons or a host of other birds and mammals, it's sometimes difficult to distinguish aggressive behavior from courtship or mating behavior. So again, depending on the animal involved and the circumstance and the time of year, it may be difficult to separate the two. But again, from my loon watching on the lake we're on in northern Wisconsin, those kinds of protracted battles and chasing are usually intruding loons bothering the resident birds. So
okay.
That's probably what it was.
All right. Thanks, Abby. Appreciate you calling in and asking us that question. Or I should say asking Scott, because I had no answer for you. Debbie in Beaver Dam called in. She could stay on the line, but she wants to know if you know of any groups that are trying to stop the wolf hunt.
Yes. There are. My short answer is going to be there are probably many, but I think that the way to find out some factual information on what is available on what side of the fence when it comes to wolves is to do a little internet work with the Timberwolf Alliance. And there's also a number of interested wolf parties working with what's called Wisconsin's Green Fire, which is an association of generally retired, not necessarily retired, but wildlife professionals who are working on a wide range of environmental issues in the state. But I'd start out with the Timber Wolf Alliance, and we actually had a couple callers today who would be knowledgeable on that front. But there are many people, both operating as individuals and as groups, on both sides of the wolf issue. And that particular fracas is just heating up again with the recent release of a DNR position announcing what they're going to propose as the quota for this fall's hunt. And it's lower than some people would like to see, and it's probably a lot higher than other people would like to see. So pick your side and do what you're motivated to do.
Okay. And we did have Terry and Roberts, who emailed in earlier, talking about letting goldfish escape. And as you had mentioned, not a good idea. Why don't you just kind of reiterate what you had said about that, Scott?
Well, I had made the comment that it's fairly common to have goldfish in a backyard water garden or water feature or whatnot, simply because they're readily available. They're kind of the poor man's koi, so to speak.
Yes.
In that you can buy a bag of feeder goldfish for a few dollars as opposed to koi, which can cost hundreds. So there's some color. They're brilliantly colored, to be sure, and some activity in a backyard water garden. But the problem, not only with goldfish, but with any aquarium fish, is that people become attached to them. And if the pond is being removed or the don't want the goldfish in the tank anymore, instead of euthanizing them or finding another home for them where it's safe, let's take them down to the pond in the park and throw them in there. And there was recently some publicity on television that showed, you know, goldfish that weighed 4 or 5 or 6 pounds, these huge obese things, which are environmentally very destructive. I mean, fundamentally, they're carp, and carp are an invasive species. And therefore, you don't put them in our waterways. We just talked about that tour that I helped lead to Florida. And when we're at the at Big Cypress, you know, National Park, the waterways are just choked with released aquarium fish coming from urban areas like Miami. You know, I remember having a funny-looking catfish in my tanks called a Placostomus catfish. And here you look in these waterways, and here are these things swimming all over the place. People, don't let your pet fish go, period. That's really,
or
that's
snakes.
Really the bottom line.
Yeah, or snakes. That's another problem in Florida, isn't it?
Or snakes, yeah. Or really anything else.
Yeah.
Pet animals belong as pets, not in the wild.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Scott, another very informative hour and a half with you. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. We have been talking about wildlife with Scott Craven, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. On the show tomorrow, we check in with our consumer protection experts about what scams are currently on the rise and how to protect ourselves against them. We'll put a spotlight on back-to-school shopping, tech support scams, and what to avoid while job hunting. That starts at 11. Hope you can join us. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well.